Okay, are we?
We're good.
Are we good now? Okay. It's 5:31. Independent Oversight Committee forum. Come to order. I apologize for the delay for those on the phone. It was unavoidable. Let us, can we introduce ourselves who are on the phone and will you take the names down for us?
Sure.
Who's on the phone right now?
Jim Dunn, this is Jakeshia Hughes with Care First Health Plan.
We had two people who were on the phone earlier. We got them.
Jack, Jim's here.
This is Joe Coachman with Banner.
This is Melissa Brown with Arizona Complete Health.
This is Haley Winterberg with Magellan Complete Care.
Yeah, I dropped.
Okay,
Jack,
well,
did you get me, Jim Dunn?
Yeah, you're there. We got you. Okay, we'll note that Jim is on the line. We go. Anyone else on the phone? Sorry, we dropped you.
Yes, Joe Coutsman with Banner.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else on the phone?
I'm making some copies of the agenda so that.
Well, those who are not members, well, why don't we all introduce ourselves? Well, we start with Mr. Moody down here.
Matthew Moody, member.
Marie Raymond, member.
Sophie Legaspi with United Healthcare.
Kathy Rowe, member.
Joy Green, family member.
Yeah, Jack Potts, right.
Larry Allen with ADOA.
Frederica Graham with Access. PJ Lizot with Access.
Karen Pacheco, and I'm a guest.
Welcome.
Who invited you?
Sort of invited myself, but you and him.
Karen and I worked together when I was an intern. It's dating me, not her.
Me too. The annex, yeah.
I'm looking at some. Okay, let's do the agenda. We'll bounce around if we have to. The first thing is introductions, which we've done. You introduce yourselves.
Is your colleague?
No, and Holly came back in. Let me give you a little brief update. Since we last met, we had questions about the manual and public input, et cetera. Holly did specifically. The manual was published 2 days after we met. You can pass this around. This is just a cover page. I suggest you go online if you wish and look at the manual. The last sentence, the last paragraph is what you should pay attention to. Now, hang on. We still have a quorum. We have 1, 2, 3.
Justice is making comments.
Yeah, just making sure. That's what anyway. We're not going to vote without him anyway. And Jim's on the line. But so I think it's important to note, and I think maybe we're going to have, take something out of order. Now we're going to have Alan talk about it, but this saves a lot of our concerns, deals with a lot of our concerns, doesn't it? If you look at that last line on there. Does anyone have any questions? Remember, we looked at the manual in detail.
Yeah, we did.
About restricting visits, have to do them 24 hours in advance, blah, blah, blah. And but this resolves that issue. Do you not think so? And, Holly?
It's not clear. It may. It's not clear only because I'm not sure that anything the committee votes to do can't be overridden or undone by the Department of Administration. But I think it's a good, it certainly gives us a good clause to work from, a good sentence to work from.
If we're talking about the manual, and the last line, the manual is now public and been approved. We did not have any more input into it, but the last line paragraph is I think, dispositive of our concerns, I believe. But,
I think there were some concerns that need agenda. I haven't gone back because I didn't mm-hmm. follow up to see if it was final. But, if they left in, for instance, that conviction of a felony precludes you from serving on one of the IOCs, I would have, that's too bad because there are people like Jeff, who's your mom and et cetera, and was actually interviewed as for the position of director of the Department of Corrections by the governor, and yet he couldn't serve on an IOC because he went to prison.
Well,
aside from that,
right now I think my reading of this, and I'd like to input if anyone has, you know, CJ, anyone, well, an input is that the last line says we don't have to adopt this. Of course, we can go ahead if we wish. And look at this. I think it gives us some time. Tells us it's simply advisory, not compulsory. And I think that was the way they dealt with not incorporating the changes we recommended, that we can do that. Anyway, so this is at least the next step, and I think our peers on the other two IOCs also think this is sort of a nice compromise. What do you think?
Well, I think so. I think it's a good faith effort to be more transparent from ADOA's perspective and from Access's perspective and DES and ASH, and to break down the silos and have everybody work together. I think it'll work. And I think it's here in the past 6 months, I think we've proved that. And I think it'll get better. Well, some things that are currently going on now. So what's some things that we're going to talk about tonight? But.
We have other thoughts. You folks at Access, what do you have thoughts on that? You were instrumental in developing the manual.
No, we didn't. We did have an opportunity to view it before it posted, but the statute says that that's between you and ADOA, so we were just waiting for it to come out.
We were told by ADOA in January, about 6-8 months ago, that actually Access was one of the stakeholders on this 8 months, 9 months
last,
ago.
Last year.
Yeah,
so in 2019, the beginning of 2019, we did give Mr. Beller all of our forms and things that he requested and our internal processes for sure. But we didn't actually have any writing of the manual or input in that.
Yeah, that's what we heard. So that's what I thought. That's why I thought you might. I didn't know to what level. Any thoughts on this? Questions at this point? Anyone? The providers here, we're going to go into special training after this, but you have a input from, who's on the line, please, from the one of the providers? Anyone on the line? Jim, are you still there?
I had something popped up on my email that said Jim said there was a problem with the code. It says Jim Dunn, I get incorrect.
Hey, Zach, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm looking at the document. The manual seems pretty good. I'm still trying to find the section that you said you like. The problem, I got a new phone, and when I go to another screen, I can never find the active phone screen. And then I got to unmute, but I'm still here. What paragraph number are you referencing that you think reflects well?
It's like page 3 of the document, and it's the very it says Arizona right at top. It's just like page 3. It's just like a little intro about who put it together. That's all. Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I'm good. I'm glad to see there's some agreement.
Yeah. Anyone else on the phone? This is lost, everyone. Except.
I'm here. This is Joe with Banner.
Oh, Joe. What updates do you have for us, Joe?
We do not have any updates at this time, sir.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else on the line?
Hi, yes, this is Ernie from Mercy Care, and we do not have any updates either at this time.
Thanks, Ernie. I'm sorry, I thought we might have lost you again. Seems to be hit and miss.
Hello, Dr. Potts. This is Jakeisha Hughes from Care First. We also don't have any updates, Jakeisha.
Thanks.
This is Haley Winterberg with Mandela and Complete Care. We also have no updates.
I'm impressed. You all found a way to find us.
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is Melissa Brown with Arizona Complete Health. I don't have any updates other than from the last meeting. You were talking about an IAD that was submitted from the actual correctional facility. I didn't hear or get any further information from anybody on the committee for specifics, but I did talk to our jail liaison, and he said that that must have just been a fluke because that's not a practice within the prison system or the correctional system. That's a behavioral health form. So somebody must have just submitted it without knowing the process, is what I'm assuming.
No. Okay. Thank you. Holly, since you're the person more involved in corrections now than most, do you remember that issue?
I missed the first part of what she said.
Would you?
Sure. So at the last meeting, somebody, I don't remember who it was, but somebody brought up the fact that whoever was reviewing the IADs, that there was an IAD that was submitted from the actual correctional facility. And you guys wanted follow-up information about it because that's not something that happens. That's not a process that happens within the correctional facility.
That may have been Jim reviewed the IADs. And Ward did, and he's not here. So I don't specifically recollect that. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. For the record, Sophie Legacy with United Healthcare. I have no updates to provide at this time.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anyone else from the agencies? Thank you. Now we're going to ask them if any questions or issues. We asked for access to help us with a couple of things, and CJ and staff said they'd be willing to sort of update us. We want some instruction on what special assistance is and how you get on that, et cetera, right? Is that what we were looking for? And that's what, let's go for it.
All right. I have to project it right there on the wall behind you.
Pulled out the plug.
Oh, it did.
It's here.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Is everybody okay if I get up and walk around? I'm a nervous presenter. Pacing helps me. if anybody else can relate to that.
I'm a special ed teacher, I understand.
You, it's distracting.
Let's see how far we get. Right, while Larry finishes setting up, I'll introduce myself. I'm CJ Loisel. I'm the Advocacy Administrator for Access. I also wear the hat of Bureau Chief for the Office of Human Rights. So today I know I've come and talked about a few other topics for some of your groups, for some of you have been there. But today we're going to focus specifically on special assistance. I know that one of your committee members is one of our master facilitators out in the community, one of our providers, and he had indicated that you guys needed some overview of what is special assistance, how do you become identified as special assistance, and then what does it mean once you are, right? So we're going to go through an overview. This is not the training that Mr. Ward would do with clinicians. This is an overview for public facing. The training that Mr. Ward does is about a 4-hour in-depth training teaching clinicians actually how to do the required assessment for our Arizona Administrative Code. So we're going to skip a lot of that. If you have questions along the way, please stop me. Again, I'm going to pace around and make everybody busy. I'll try to keep it to a minimum.
Member of the committee, just to, if I may, CJ, Jim said he does this training and be willing to do this. And he said, however, that he'd have to check with his superior to see if that was a program he may have touched base with you. And he said he'd do this. And he does a different training, too. And he could not make it today because he had an emergency meeting call at 5:30. He may join us. I'm calling this one, you know.
All right. So, again, so Dr. Potts, the training that Jim does out in the community, 4 hours, very clinical, high level. But if you have questions as we go through it, feel free to come. All right. So OHR, the Office of Human Rights, is a state advocacy office established in Arizona Administrative Code. Those of you who are familiar with that section of code, R-921, notice that 104 is right next to 105, where the office or the independent oversight committee lives. So a lot of the actions and the requirements of the Office of Human Rights are similar to what you see as what the IOCs do and what you guys see as far as deliverables and reports. So feel free to ask questions on the differences and things like that as we go through. Right, our code provides that we employ at least one state advocate for every 2,500 SMI members to be inserted.
Are you going to go over what an advocate is and what they do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
cool. And we also have one advocate assigned to the state hospital. Okay, that's what's written into code, and that's really all that was written into code. So there's nothing in the codes or the statutes that tell you what an advocate is, to your point, or what they do. So we'll go through that. We're going to focus real quick on what a special assistance is. Okay, so special assistance is a support, and it helps provide individuals with SMI who are also unable, due to their specific conditions, to communicate their preferences and participate effectively in formal processes to behavioral health. So development of treatment plan, implementation of a service plan or a discharge plan, basically access to covered services and formal processes like the SMI appeal, grievance, or investigation process. Okay? So because of their current status, state or stasis, yeah. There, where they're at with their behavioral health condition, this can come fluidly. So today, because I'm experiencing increased symptomology, I may not be able to participate in this, which is required to start like immediately when I go inpatient, right? But I'm just not stable yet, so I don't understand my service options, my discharge planning options. So today, I might require the assistance of an advocate to make sure that the inpatient team and my outpatient providers are one, working together, and two, offering all safe covered services that could be implemented into the district. Okay? So that's one of the main reasons that special assistance goes on and off, people's symptomology changes. Next slide. Thank you, Mr.
I'm a clicker.
You're a great clicker. So our mission over at OHR is to provide advocacy to individuals determined to have serious mental illness to help them understand, protect, exercise their rights, and facilitate self-advocacy through education and obtaining access to behavioral health services in the publicly funded behavioral health system in Arizona. It's a really long mission statement, but if you notice, this does not say just special assistance members. So we'll talk a little bit about the difference between providing advocacy for
as my members that are not designated special assistants and advocacy for members that are special assistants as we go along. Just focusing on special assistance, the population when I served with OHR was under 1,500 identified special assistance members statewide. We are now just over 2,000. An enormous change.
What do you attribute that to?
A lot of it was education on proper identification. We've done, OHR provides about an average of 2 training sessions per month through various SMI provider sites, health plans, hospitals, urgent psychiatric centers, just any clinician that comes in contact with our SMI members, we're constantly offering to train on how to identify special assistance members. Although it has increased the amount of folks that we're working with on the day-to-day basis, it's great because those folks obviously weren't getting that special attention and that support prior to. So. Even at that, with over 3,000 folks identified as special assistants, the total special assistance is only 7% of the entire SMI population in the state. Of that 7%, only 2% is assigned to an OHR advocate on a regular basis. We've given them cases so that they can maintain relationships with folks. So once an advocate's assigned, that advocate stays with a person until they no longer need special assistance. The other 5% is where I spend the majority of my time. Those are natural supports and guardians. So we'll talk a little bit more about guardians, but in that whole bucket, we identify those folks as special assistants for a couple of reasons. One, yeah.
So with this, you have 3,100 people enrolled in special assistance, but only a minority of those actually need help from SA advocates, right? So do they still employ 2 whole people to do this, or do they only count the amount of people that don't have natural advocates?
We have 1 for every 2,500 enrolled because we actually serve all of them. Even
if they have got it.
We're directly case assigned to this 2%. So as we go through, I'll explain the difference on what. So technical assistance is available to all SMI members. Anyone who calls any one of our 3 offices across the state and says, hey, I received services in the behavioral health system. This is who I am. I need help filing a grievance. I need help finding a form to file a grievance. I tried to file a grievance and they didn't take it. And we can help them, right? We also get a lot of calls from families that say, my person is seriously mentally ill and not able to do a thing, and they won't tell me anything about him. That's a big one. Now, we can't just go get into a person's record because their family member told us to, but we can certainly reach out to a clinic and ask them, did you assess properly? And if you didn't, we're going to make sure you did. 9 times out of 10, they assign an advocate, or ask to have an advocate assigned right away. So we get a lot of calls from the 93%, but this section is natural support.
So there's roughly 40,000 SMI in Arizona. 2% of those, right?
Mm-hmm.
So 2% of 40,000,
yeah,
are special assistants.
Yeah, 7% of 40,000 are special assistants.
7%.
Yes, 2% are assigned to a state-employed advocate.
It's also 3,100 in the previous slide.
Five of that 7% have natural support advocates.
Meaning family, friends.
Guardians, pastors.
Okay, yeah.
We'll talk a little bit about that when we get to who can meet the needs of a member who is special.
And 2% are state-paid advocates.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. And can you tell us, is this the place to talk about what are the qualifications of an advocate?
We can talk about that when we get to
the advocate.
But we have a very diverse group. Well, the teams are not here. There's not actually a slide on that. So the advocates have to have at least 2 years in the behavioral health field, related field. We have a very diverse group. Some of those folks have come out of behavioral health justice in the justice system. Some of them have come out of the integrated SMI clinic. Some of them have come out of inpatient units, lots of previous clinicians. Some of them have worked at health plans. Some of them have worked for public community type of resources like the city's housing program. So it depends on their background, but the minimum qualification is at least 2 years in a related health care or a bachelor's degree and a year, I think is the
other segment.
So they have to have a bachelor's degree?
They can have experience or.
Experience,
yeah. A bachelor's degree is always preferred on like our postings. But if you have 7 years as a peer recovery specialist in the SMI service industry, you're probably going to know the system better than somebody who just got out of college, right? To be able to connect with someone who's going through something.
Bachelor's degree in anything or bachelor's degree in
social service is related to the other side.
And then do they get training?
Yes.
Are, is there a certification, a licensure? Or?
There's not.
Okay.
We are not services, but we'll talk about that later. So we're a support, not a service, not an entitlement. So it's a little bit different than like our VHTs and CHPs in the clinic. Questions? The general requirements to meet the special assistance criteria is, of course, folks have to be SMI. And then we're going to talk about how to notify the Office of Human Rights and who can meet their criteria. So who can assess and who is required to assess by Arizona Administrative Code? All qualified clinicians, this means case managers, clinical team members, TREBA, REBA, contractor health plan, staff that interacts with the member, program directors of subcontracted providers, and that one was new because there's a subcontracted contractor from DBD to their new health plan. Talk about that later in our update that we talked about access contracting. The access deputy director and all administrative hearing officers are required to assess for special assistance if a person doesn't seem to understand the process, isn't able to track and advocate for themselves. They're supposed to stop those proceedings and ask for technical assistance from the Office of Human Rights. Any questions, please?
Is there a hard copy printout from this?
I carry it for security. Now I'm more nervous.
I'm too late to go up.
All right, what can I trade you?
I'm good, I'm good. I still got my other two. All right, next slide. So the basic criteria is member, if a member of a court-appointed attorney, a court has already determined that the person is incapacitated and not able to make treatment decisions, right? So that's the number one. If there's already a guardian involved, that person is meeting the needs of the person in a little different fashion. We'll talk about that. But we know that the member's already incapacitated. So we identify them as special assistants, and those go on that special assistance report that we send out to you every month. Partly so that you can follow up with those guardians if you visit their members on a site visit or something and see if something's going on that their guardian might need to be aware of. Sometimes their guardians come to your meetings and ask for help, things like that. So they're always going to be on them.
How do we know they have a guardian? Is
it's on the Excel special. It's on the special system.
It's on the report.
Yes.
Okay.
And the number.
Yeah. All right. And then is the... Oh, go back.
Sorry.
No, okay. And then are they, we went too far. Or appointed guardian, and then they're not able to do any of the following. Communicate their preferences, as we said. Participate effectively in the service planning, inpatient treatment and discharge planning, and then any appeal, grievance, or investigation process. A little duplicate. All right. So once a person is identified to not being able to participate, they have to link to one of these categories. So when the clinicians are doing their assessment, they have to determine, like, what is it that's causing that, right? So we have the psychiatric disorder and symptomology, and then we also may have other issues, like a cognitive ability, intellectual capacity or diminished capacity, language barriers that are not using a translator, which is not the same. And then medical issues, which is pretty much the most common, and this is based on the increased severe psychiatric symptoms. Individuals who are under the general guardianship, they're found incapacitated, they're automatic. I want to point that out again because I didn't mention it before. Temporary or limited guardian. So someone that's appointed just to make medical decisions. I need a root canal. They won't give me any anesthesia because they don't think I can consent to it. Something like that. That doesn't mean they're incapacitated. It just means that they need that limited.
Sorry for so many questions. I just find this very interesting. Do you have any idea on what the most common of those four reasons is? Because in my mind, from case management, all I can think of is someone who's having a psychotic episode or a manic episode that's so bad that they can't even communicate
Number four.
Okay. And is it like
about
those?
80% of the time.
The two examples I just gave?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, medical issues, including but not limited to severe psychiatric symptoms that affect communication.
So, four, then, is that dovetail with Alprexol, or is what's your Alprexol SMI, or what's that?
Alprex, it remains SMI. SMI doesn't go away because you age.
Okay.
Right.
So a lot of those would be memory units and other medical issues, and that's what you're saying. It's an Alprex. One would presume it may be Alprex as well.
A lot of the time, yeah. We have, right now, just because of the demographics of our state and our nation, we have a lot of those baby boomers aging into that little area between. We know it's SMI diagnosis, and we know it's dementia. There's kind of that gray area in the middle. And we have a large population in our nation right now because of the baby boomers in that age group, right? So that doesn't go away just because they're ill. You know, they're all aging the same with their peers. So we do see that a lot more to your point. Next slide. Okay. What criteria is not? A person who needs things explained in simpler terms, or may need additional time to understand information. So it's an expectation that an SMI case manager would spend the amount of time explaining service options to a patient with regular symptoms of having a mental illness, correct? A person that is able but not willing to participate. So the very first human right that those folks have is the right to refuse treatment, right? If they shouldn't be able to refuse that treatment, there are other processes that aren't our office that would remove their right to make that choice, like guardianship. And then once the guardianship, they would be special assistance, but that's not a reason. So if a person is saying, I don't want treatment, that's not a reason to ask for an advocate. Okay, we need to be clear with case managers. Or I don't want that treatment. That's their right, right? And if they're not able to do that anymore, our state has processes to support that. They can speak and advocate for themselves, but present with interpersonal issues. So just because they cuss their case managers out or don't shower very often, that's their right, their choice, and until it becomes, again, one of those issues, that there's another, you know, system that would help support that. OHR and our natural support advocates, other than guardians, aren't able to change those things. And we can't make a decision for a member. We can't say, he doesn't want to go to be at Reynolds Residential, but we're going to make him. We can't do that. Need more regular engagement or re-engagement. So members who go missing, OHR can't go out and find them. We can't pick them up. We're not case managers. We're support to help them with treatment planning once our case managers do. We have systems for that. Okay. When our members assess, if you got to click this one like seven times, always get their initial intake for assessment and then ongoing, which means prior to every ISP meeting or review, prior to ICDP meetings and reviews, when a grievance or an appeal is filed, or, and this is a big one that we have to remind case managers all the time, when conditions exist that may constitute basis for filing a grievance or an appeal. So basically, your clinicians out in the field are supposed to be, just by nature of what they do, ensuring that their patients are tracking and understanding and able to digest the information that's being given all the time. Anytime that I interact with my case manager, they should be making sure that I understand what this is. Right? And that's bottom line what this is. The person's not able to understand and make choices, then you stop and you get them help. Right? So the providers are required to assess whether the individual is in need of special assistance using
the criteria. That last one.
Sure.
So if someone files a grievance or appeal, why would that trigger the obvious thing?
Well, whether it's the case manager or the intake person at the health plan dealing with the SMI grievance or appeal, they need tracking to make sure the member understands that process. So if it's a grievance, there's going to be an interview.
So they're being assessed. So it's an ongoing assessment rather than a manager. It's more. What's clinical, how they're doing today versus mandatory, maybe we should kick them off for special assistance.
Right. Okay. Ongoing. Clinically, how are we doing? Yes. Perfect. So once they assess if a person meets criteria or not, or not, that's a big one, they have to document it. So if they assess that the member is able to participate and does not need special assistance pay, then in order to document that, they have to write it down, right? If we don't write it down, never happens. Okay.
Didn't happen.
Can't prove anything. Mm-hmm. All right. If the individual does meet criteria, our clinical teams have 5 working days to identify the individual as a need of special assistance and notify the Office of Human Rights. Okay? It's not a lot of time in the behavioral health world where their case managers have 70, 80 clients, right? So we try and make it as important as we possibly can to them, and we want to know right away because 5 days is a super long time if you're that member that doesn't understand your entitled services and needs help today. That is like eternity. So I get a lot of questions on why is that time frame so short? To me, that is not short. If I was that person or that person was my person, but I would want to make sure that they were called immediately.
How is this different than persistently or acutely disabled?
Those folks typically already have a guardian. But it's not much different. That is one of the barriers. Like, if they're that, then why don't they have an advocate if they don't have a guardian? Yes.
Okay, so then, I mean, then the next issue is how can one be voluntary, you know, if you're that, if you're special assistance, which you have PAD, someone doesn't understand the need meds and can't use informed consent, thinking, which is what this is, that's one of the criteria for special assistance, essentially, right? So it's like, you see where I'm going on that, Josh? You know, the point is, you know, are people who are special assistants, should they be all committed? Are they capable of voluntary treatment? Unless they have a guardian.
I think they are. So my job as their advocate is to ensure that they maintain as much independence as they possibly can.
What if they don't want medications, which keeps them sort of very crazy but still docile?
Yeah, and that's up to their. So that's a good point, but it's not an advocate's responsibility like a guardian responsibility to make a person. It is our job to make sure that the clinical team is assessing for those needs and following those formal processes. Does that make sense? So although our advocates have backgrounds in various clinical levels of service to our members, as an advocate, they are not allowed to use special assessments. They are using system navigation advocacy and member education. And so it would be inappropriate for them to determine if someone needs to go through the Title 36 process or guardianship. Because our job isn't to take away their rights. Our job is to try and help them understand and exercise those rights on their own for as long as they can. If they're not able to do that, there are systems in place for guardianship proceedings and things are outside of this purview. Available. Okay. Any questions?
Do you consider that a fiduciary responsibility?
Determining whether or not someone needs treatment?
Being an advocate.
Yes. But I am a fiduciary for one of my persons. I'm always going to be their advocate. Okay. All right. An individual with special needs is different from an individual with need of special assistance. So, some examples of people with special needs. They don't speak English. We need interpreters for that. They don't know how to read and write. Our clinicians and case managers are required to help them with those sort of things and provide them education and support opportunities to overcome those barriers. Deaf or hearing, again, we have translators and various things that are required for for accommodations that to make sure that our members are able to understand as best as they can. Basically with this, I like to point out that just because members receive services from the Division of Developmental Disabilities doesn't mean that they're always not able to do this, right? For instance, a person with cerebral palsy and serious mental illness doesn't mean that person's got a cognitive deficit that they're not able to make any decisions anymore, right? So a lot of people ask me in training, well, so everybody that's in DDD should be special assistants, right? No,
Absolutely not. Once they need it. It's a great support, but it's not considered the least restrictive. The least restrictive is I'm able to do this by myself, right? That's why the OHR goal is to educate and empower self-advocacy. All right. So the clinical teams and the health plans are required to arrange for qualified interpreters, translators, and staff who speak languages and other reasonable accommodations to meet special needs. So again, just another backup is the reason that family members are struggling or want advocates is because they're not being provided with things that are required, like interpreters. Those are entitlements. So we can help a family member help their members get those things. In fact, that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to end up being special assistants. So in determining whether someone needs special assistance criteria, it's important to that the provider that is assessing them is familiar with them, looks at the whole picture, recognizes that special needs and other factors may not always satisfy special assistance criteria. There's collaboration needed, depending on a person's current situation, right? And if the individual does meet special assistance criteria and is not already identified, that they must do so, regardless of whether the person has a guardian, already has someone involved, or the designated representative. So sometimes we'll go out and we'll work with providers who don't quite understand special assistance and find out that they're serving, you know, a good amount of members that have guardians. They're like, well, why do they need special assistance if they have a guardian? Again, we identify those members so that you guys and the independent oversight committees who get the special assistance list and the Office of Human Rights can reach out and help those family members and guardians that are supporting these individuals that are already determined incapacity. Okay, so what does OHR do? What do the advocates do? We provide free of charge. We had to throw that in there. We had a few complaints that there were people that have advocacy services that charge members to be their advocate. So we like to define that out, especially in public presentations, that an OHR representative does not charge. It's not a service. There's no fee. We support individuals that are SMI and identified as special assistants and assigned an OHR advocate by preparing for and assisting with service planning. We participate in the service planning meeting. Sometimes it's by phone, depending on how many of those we have scheduled every day. Following up on the implementation of services that were identified and written into the service plan. Support with the appeal and grievance process. And ongoing support in the development of self-advocacy. We spend a lot of time here. We at OHR like to call these pre and post meetings with our members. So before we would go into a service plan, an advocate may spend half an hour, an hour even, depending on the member and their ability to communicate timely, what is it that you would like to see, and going over what services might be able to help support that long-term goal or even that short-term goal. And then after the meeting, we'll spend some time, we call those post-meetings, going over what happened and how well that person did speaking up for themselves, what they could do better next time, what they might need, or how they felt. Sometimes this is where we find out the most from a person on how they actually feel about their relationship with their clinical team or even family members that are attending those meetings right after a meeting. We do that debriefing and that self-advocacy education. Again, advocates provide support, and OHR is not a service. Question?
What does that mean?
So covered services, it's not part of a Medicaid-funded program, right? So the only reason that Access employs advocates is because the Arizona Administrative Code tells us that they have to. But the actual support that we provide is not a covered service, and it's not Medicaid reimbursable. Sometimes that comes up in way of an appeal, like I want to appeal my advocate or my clinical team says I do or I do not need an advocate. They can appeal the outcome of the assessment, but it's not a service appeal, right? You can appeal the outcome of any assessment or the determination of any assessment. So, but we have to be very clear that that's not a covered service. Sometimes it comes into question, and we're the only state that has it, so it makes CMS and Medicaid eyebrows go.
And you have the pre and post. You said the meeting pre and post. Now say, where does that occur?
Well, it depends on the member, and it depends on the advocate and the placement. You know, so like if
That's an internal process and some lingo that our team has come up with to kind of measure their amount of education they're doing with their members. But most commonly, a lot of our members are inpatient, and then a lot of our members that are assigned are also in behavioral residential facilities, flex care settings, various different licensed treatment facilities.
Oh, does that happen like at a staffing? Is that like
usually before or after? Pre and post meeting would be.
So you have a staffing schedule.
Mm-hmm.
So before the staffing, they should be meeting before the staffing occurs,
if
and then after the staffing.
Yeah, if the members are agreeable, ideally. I mean, if you were learning something new, okay, or if you were learning something that you've always done one way and learning to do it a different way, which is what learning self-advocacy is for a lot of our members. Sometimes you need some build-up, right? Because if your MO has been for 5 years working with the system and that same clinical team, that when you sit down to do your annual service plan update, you put your head in your hands and hate that everybody's talking about you and grunt when it's appropriate where you think it is, right? So before we go in that meeting, we want to talk about this is for you. This is about your choices. This is about your goals. This is what we're going to do. Do you want me to say that or do you want to say that? Prepping a person. Participate in the meeting and then post. Now, not all of our members have the patience to do that or the desire to do it, but that's the goal.
Well, in personal experience, I haven't had that in because my daughter was involved with the special assistance and all that, and this is new to me. This pre and post.
It's actually the pre and post meeting. What the hell have I been focusing on the event? And they identified it through their team huddle as a need that they wanted to do. And they actually put a definition to it like October, November. So it's really.
There's usually people just run. It's over. They're gone.
Yeah,
you know, you're like,
yeah.
Hey, can I talk to you? I got to go. I got another thing scheduled.
They do.
And it's like,
they do carry quite large people. So they are running a lot of the time, which is one of the reasons. And it was the advocates that worked at the police office that kind of came up with that idea that we need to slow down.
This is a really necessary thing.
It is.
And I'm glad you put it in place.
I can't take all the credit. They really need that time to come up with this stuff themselves. But I do support it.
So it says the provider must maintain open communication with the person providing special assistance. Okay, so that's the assigned advocate, guardian, family member, or friend. So somebody can have a family member and an assigned advocate, right?
Sure.
Okay. So who does the provider talk to first?
Whoever's identified as person meeting you. So when you get your special assistance list, there's a name of the advocate and a relationship type right there on there. So sometimes it's sister, sometimes it's OHR, sometimes it's guardian, sometimes it's other family.
Mom.
It says sister, mother, OHR, gives phone contact numbers. Yeah.
So is every advocate asked to sign a medical record? Is the patient asked to sign a medical records release for every advocate?
Patients with Yeah.
Okay. So if the patient has signed one for the advocate and the patient has signed one for the family member and there's no guardian, if the advocate calls, the provider talks to the advocate for what purpose?
Well, they're required to.
Well, I understand that, but that's why they talk to them. But what purpose are they talking to them?
Usually for planning a meeting, because they have to notify us 10 days prior to the service plan meeting, or letting us know that the person's inpatient, we need to arrange a discharge planning meeting, so you have to do that within 72 hours. So, I mean, there's quite a few reasons that they would contact a designated rep. They're required to by Arizona Administrative Code to contact designated representatives at very, very
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is the process is to ensure involvement, and I get that, but who's going to sit down with the provider on a priority basis and talk about, okay, Billy's been now in the hospital at St. Luke's, and he's been here 5 times in the last year. And he stays for 7 to 10 days, if he's lucky, and then he goes home, and then he gets picked up again, and then he gets taken to UPC, and we're back here in another 6 weeks. Who does the provider talk to in a preference way?
the family member or the advocate?
Well, the advocate is assigned as a designated rep. They have to talk to the designated rep for those required functions.
Okay. And
but the in-between meetings, the difference is the designated representative can't make determinations or have meetings with the clinical team without the member. We do everything with the member.
Okay.
So sometimes a natural support, like a mom, will get a release of information signed so a clinical team can talk to me when I call.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes that's better for the relationship, right? I call when my daughter's not sitting next to me. So I can say, here's what she's been showing as far as symptomology at home, and here's what I'm afraid of, right?
I kept in constant
contact.
Because
if I say that for my daughter, what does she do? She runs away.
Right.
She doesn't trust me. She gets her feelings hurt. That's different. That type of an ROI, we support that 100%. But if an advocate is fine, we need to have a meeting and we need to talk about things with the member, right? Clinicians can call us and say, hey, been in St. Luke's again. We need to talk. We need to have a meeting. You know, we're thinking one thing or another. Do you have input? And the advocate's going to say, I'm sure I do, but I have to check with my member first. I'm his representative. That he says, I'm his representative.
So
different than a guardian, different than a mom with an ROI.
Okay. So the advocate is going to advocate at, you have this meeting. You have a meeting. Everybody's notified that the member comes in and says, I don't want treatment.
Yep.
I want to go back to the street. I want to continue to do this or that. And if I come back here 100 times in the next year, I don't care. I'm going back to the street. What is the advocate's role, if any, in trying to say, we need to look at whether this is really working in your best interest, or is best interest defined as whatever the member wants?
It's a tricky role because we're not allowed to make those clinical determinations and decide what services are right around. But what our team does is work on educating the member that if you exercise that, here's what the consequences look like. And that's the best we can do. But that is, again, where we run into there are clinical team members and doctors that are around that know those other processes. If this person is becoming a danger to themselves, we have a process for that, right? If this person needs a guardian to make decisions for them because it's gotten to that point, there's a process for that. But no, your OHR advocate is not going to say, file for guardianship, file for Title 36. Those things remove a person's rights. Our job is to protect their rights.
Okay, so your job is to keep that from happening.
No, we don't interfere. The clinical determination is
made.
It's
for what the patient wants.
Yeah.
And it's just like with
the
police department.
We don't interfere with any of those processes.
It's like when the police come out.
Yeah, we
and then it's like, they're like, they have rights. They have absolute rights. There's nothing we can do. If they don't want to go to the hospital, if they don't want to go, then they don't have to go. And then they drive off. The police drive off. And you're left there.
Wait, who tells the police that?
No, the police. The police come. You tell us this. We came out, and then it's like she's definitely like a 51-50, and they're like, well, no, really. And it's like, okay, she has the right to. Okay, I said she needs to go to UPC. She needs to go to 99th Avenue. We asked her. She said no, thank you. And so they say, well, she has rights. We can't do anything about that. And they get in their cars and they drive off.
Yeah.
Please.
You know, you're using your California lingo back then. 50.
Sorry, it's New York.
If there's a guardian in place, there can be also a person providing special assistance. I understand they're in the special assistance pool, but does that preclude, if there's a guardian, does that preclude
OHR?
I lost mine. When I became guardian, I lost my
OHR.
Yeah. Yeah, the guardianship takes a person's rights and gives them to somebody. So
yeah,
what happens at that point is then, so your person used to have special assistance.
Mm-hmm.
You're now the guardian, so she's probably still in special assistance. And if you reach out to OHR and say, I'm a designated observer, I'm a guardian, and my person, blah, 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 my clinical team's not doing what I think they're supposed to, I don't know what to do next, we can provide technical.
Really?
Yeah.
On the Excel list, guardians appear to have priority, so once you get a guardian, they bump, they're banged. That's a contact person, that's the same by the OHRs. I don't think there's duplicate representation is what we're hearing.
They have a higher authority than we do. They take on the rights of the person to choose.
Ours was awesome.
Okay, so that's not quite my question, though, Jeff. So, what is the term that I should be using here? What's the person who is assigned before they get knocked off by the guardian?
OHR advocate.
OHR advocate.
Support. It's technically, if you look into the law, it's a designated representative.
The person from OHR would be a designated representative. Okay. Does the guardian prohibit the person, the member, from having a designated representative through OHR?
No, but it would be a moot point. So,
but
the guardian has a higher authority.
But guardians oftentimes have trouble
yes.
getting services, talking to clinical teams,
right.
getting any response whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be a moot point. It would be nice to have someone from special assistance.
They can call our office and they get the technical assistance. So the person themselves doesn't have an advocate assigned. The guardian can get advocate assistance, and that's usually from Rudy in Maricopa County, who's the lead advocate here. Leah Ballesteros, she's the lead advocate for the Greater GSA, or myself, because we don't carry caseloads. Well, they carry like 10 to 12, but we don't carry caseloads with 70 members that don't have anybody. So we go and we help educate them on service selection and navigate to the members.
So that's my source of confusion. A guardian can and does make decisions for the person.
Yes.
Okay. And an advocate doesn't, but you lose an advocate when you get a guardian,
yes.
even though they're doing very different things.
Well, except if you think about it, if I have an advocate for me, I say I want this, it doesn't make sense because a guardian can just ignore that totally. So it's throwing in a potential competition. I think the answer to this is, and what Jar's saying, is then the guardian goes and talks and does a grievance with OHR and say we want assistance in this case. But if I have an advocate and you're my guardian, my advocate's going to listen to me, but you can overrule it, doesn't mean. So I think that creates more conflict, frankly. I'm just telling you.
Yeah. You know, to be clear, guardians don't have to file a grievance to get assistance.
Then they have a guardian. The guardian can step up and make sure that decisions are made as far as treatment goes.
Right.
So I think it goes back to how somebody enters the process.
But members with, and I was going to go over that in the slide with the 5% and explaining this, where I spend the majority of my time, is those natural supports. So even someone that's not a guardian, but maybe it's mom who wanted to be special assistance designated representative for her person, but I don't really quite know how, right? So even those folks, they'll be assigned in that assignment, that designated representative form that goes to the clinical team that put on the special assistance list means clinical team, don't care if you like mom, she's here when you have service planning. She's here when you have discharge planning, and she has access to records. This is all here. That's the benefit for parents who don't have that other avenue of their children voluntarily signing ROI. We can designate and rep them through the special assistance program.
And I know the other thing is that when we get in...
No, the members can object.
And when we get into, a lot of the SMI get into the court system, and, you know, they're told, okay, we want them assigned to a FACT team, and then they get on the FACT teams, and then it was like, nobody from human rights can go into court and can't do anything along those lines.
Like a guardian,
can't
do that.
Right.
You have no authority in the justice system at all. So, we have worked really hard with the jails. To allow us to participate in treatment planning meetings because people are in and out of jail,
mm-hmm.
which has been great. That's been a huge initiative over the last few years, and those relationships have gotten better, but we still can't do anything with prison or court.
With what?
Prison or court. Criminal court. Or mental health court.
Can't touch the legal stuff. You can't go to
How is
court, you mean?
Mental health court? They can't go to mental health court.
We can't represent our members in the criminal justice and mental health justice, any justice system.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Only the behavioral health system. That's the only thing we have any access to.
How is provider defined? Is it any SMI contracted provider? Is it just the providers that are providing direct services, like the direct care clinics? Is it a place like UPC? How is that defined, do you know?
Yes, it is. It's a place like UPC. So urgent psychiatric centers and hospitals, I mean, as far as involving the...
Family members and guardians are cut off from communication all the time. The place that it happens most is at the crisis center. So I'm wondering if the crisis centers fall under provider, because I assume this isn't at the admin code somewhere.
They do fall under provider, and we have recently moved the special assistance database to an online provider-facing portal, partly for that reason, so that, because those crisis units, members don't always tell them that they have a guardian or an advocate, even an OHR advocate, so they need to have access to that. And if you remember, the special assistance list used to be done just on an Excel spreadsheet that was broken into 1,000 pieces, sent to 1,000 providers, changed, brought back, re-aggregated, and sent to you guys and sent to OHR in various providers like UPC. By the time they got it and you got it, it was 6 months old, right? Completely useless. So this way, and we're already using it that way, when providers make that 5-day update, it immediately draws when you pull that report out of that portal. And so we're currently in the process of training inpatient units, including the urgent psychiatric units, to get into that portal and access that so that they can run patients as soon as they come in contact with them. So that should help for folks that are identified. You can't help if they're not identified.
And let's say sometimes when you drop, oh, my child has, you know, a special assistance advocate, it's like, oh.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, hmm.
That's good.
You got a hammer. You got a hammer. Yeah. You know? It's like, yes.
So I have a question about so you gave the example of a clinical team and they don't like dealing with mom, but mom's the, you know, natural advocate, so they need to inform mom. Would that not be a deterrent for the clinical team to not agree that the client does need an advocate? So, because the person who can refer to get an advocate would be the clinical team, correct?
Well,
and if the clinical team says, we don't feel like dealing with this person.
You have power and they don't like them.
Right.
So, let me just back up real quick for you boys and do some language correction, because that is often mistaken. Nobody refers for special assistance. Clinical teams are required to assess for special assistance criteria, and they are required to notify. So it's requirements. So if you guys have families or know people that are having trouble with that, mm-hmm. like they think that their person would want them to be a designated rep, they think they need an advocate, there's no problem with contacting OHR and saying, my person receives their services here, here's his name, I don't think they're assessing for special assistance. We can do a request on that request.
Mm-hmm.
We can't talk back to you if you're not a guardian, but if you give us that information, we'll ask you for your member's, your person's number. We can give that back to the person. We can definitely file a grievance on behalf of your person. Again, if you're not the guardian, you're not privy, we can't tell you that stuff, but any reasonable person can file an SMI grievance on behalf of a member at any time. So what happens with those is if we get that kind of a call from a family member, the first thing we do is reach out to that SMI provider, say, you know who it is, right? And say, send us your documentation of the last 4 times that you assessed this member for special assistance, along with the dates of all the last face-to-face visits with the case member and case manager in the last 6 months. Is they're required to assess when?
Ongoing. Yeah.
Which means all the time.
Yeah.
It
right.
Should be documented.
Because they're clinicians. And if it's not documented, and if it didn't happen, I'm going to file a grievance on behalf, and I'll bet you that assessment's going to get done.
If a natural advocate has no authority for anything unless they have an ROI.
Other than involvement.
Well, no, if they don't have an ROI, they don't have it. A natural advocate, a mother who wants to consult her son, has no authority.
Once they are assigned on the special assistance list, yes, they
if they're assigned on there, that means they've got an ROI, right?
Yes.
Okay, and that's the point. You have to have that first before you can even get on here. Otherwise, it's kind of meaningless.
Okay.
Good. No, we're finished?
No.
We can be finished.
You're doing great.
We got
Let's fix that. You guys have more questions, I thought.
No, it's good. Well, let me ask you.
Some of it's redundant, so I'm going to say wrong.
There's 80 people on the special assistance list who are homeless.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have OHRS.
Yes.
What's going on there?
Well, it depends on each member's situation.
Well, what do you do? I mean, these people who are homeless probably aren't compliant with medicine with them necessarily. What do you, I mean,
that's not always the case.
No, I know it's not always the case. But I'm saying, what do you think? Is it some sort of higher risk patient to look at?
Well, yes. We do track that. We also track, and I don't know if you guys all have seen this, but our OHR annual report got dropped into your folder. You saw that? So one of the things that we track in there is our avoiding homelessness. So we track it, and we work to advocate for a person to get into whatever it is.
How can somebody who's a special assistance member, not on a VI SPDAT, go right to the top of the list?
Doesn't mean they don't.
Okay, I guess...
The top of the list is very long.
Well, it's 2,500. It's 2,500 people in Maricopa County. But I guess I don't understand.
I guarantee you that the special assistants identified SMI members that are homeless that are on that list probably have some of the highest scores on the list.
Yeah.
But prioritization does not increase capacity. And that's an unfortunate thing. But
we hear all the time that there's plenty of housing. Well, we hear it.
I don't run housing, but I do know this, that our members that are on that list, it is a frustrating experience, and they have those VIs. I don't know if you ever seen one or seen an interview for one getting filled out. There's some horrible answers to some horrible questions to get that score. And it's heartsickening that we have anybody who's been through the kind of thing.
So I guess
folks have been waiting for home, but they are, and that's reality. We can advocate for prioritization. We can advocate for.
Well, I know of a provider in town who offered, who had housing donated, or was going to pay for housing, properties, and all they needed was for the REBA to agree to pay for the services. And the river wouldn't. Now, that's not your problem.
Well, it's all of our problem.
I'm just saying.
It's not something I can speak to.
Yeah, I keep coming back to what I can't ever get. I can't wrap my head around this. Two numbers. $2.5 billion is what Arizona spends a year on the SMI population. So we spend $2.5 billion for 40,000 people. I can't do the math and figure out how 80 special assistance people can't have housing out of that $2.5 I just don't get it. And I know you're working hard to advocate whatever that means, but how do we have 80 people when we special assistance with no housing and we spend $2.5 billion for 40,000 people?
I'll tell you what I think is pretty impressive. That's 80 people out of 3,100. That's a pretty good percentage when you look at the overall population.
Why do you say that?
That's how many people are on the special
list. No. What's the standard? Is there a standard and a fidelity measure?
Absolutely not. I wish there was. That would be excellent. But I'm saying that these are some of our most vulnerable, and that is a lower percentage than overall.
I understand.
But it isn't enough.
I'm not.
We do our best, and I think it is outstanding. That number's not ever been that low before. Let me tell you that.
And I think. One is unacceptable. One,
right.
One special assistance person who is homeless in a $2.5 billion system is a failure.
Who wants housing?
Well, that's another whole discussion. But okay. I think it's a failure. I think it's a failure that we have a system that lets somebody who wants that to not be able to provide services that are meaningful enough and acceptable to that person who's homeless.
I think that's a failure.
That has nothing to do with this program, though. I mean, that's
well, she was talking about the number of patients, and I asked about the VI SPDAT and why weren't they high, and she said they are. They would be right at the top, but there's not enough housing.
Yes.
It's a capacity issue.
Not an OHR issue.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think it is an OHR issue. OHR issue, because I think if yeah, it's very hot.
Okay, we got to, you know.
I think it should be more of a priority.
Well, it's my priority, too. I agree with you. Just so you guys know, there's a few slides we didn't get to, but we did get a lot of the questions that would come from those slides. ADOA's agreed to turn this into a PDF and put it on your ILC website page. So all these ones that we do, and there's several others. You are welcome to keep that.
Thanks.
That's the one with my speakers on time.
Oh, well, thank
you.
I didn't see him yet.
Yeah.
Pretty clean copy, girl.
Huh?
Any other questions? Because
well, most of it's in my head. I didn't refer to
it. Any other questions? Or any from the public questions?
Thank you.
Yeah, let me, while you're here, one of the things we want to talk about before we mention is what's going to happen with the RFPs, et cetera, with access report in 2021, correct?
Mm-hmm.
It's going into effect. Stuff change will occur. There is a link that I sent you all that was a letter that CJ was kind of sent with the public presentation as to what to look forward to with access and the combining of the care and all that. So look at that. If you have questions, we can maybe address them later because you've been very responsive. But it is, you all have that link, and it's a PowerPoint presentation. You're going to say it's because there's no more public presentations here. There'll be in Tucson, Flagstaff, and Yuma. So the Phoenix one is passed last week, I think. Went by about 10 days ago.
But if you want to do a special one for your group,
right.
They said that they would be more than willing to have OISA and our AD over the Department of Community Advocacy and Intervention and Information. have agreed. They've been putting that on. We attend sometimes, but it's really them. But they would need to come out here. That's longer than mine, though.
We can cut it short. Let me ask. One of the things that Joy and I and others noted, we go by the special assistance list when we do random site visits. Some of the places we see, we have problems thinking of a St. Bernard living in them, that, needless to say, of having a mentally ill person living in them.
It's abusive.
Well, they're pretty ratty, and in fact, we've seen them, we'll talk about that about what doing on the site visit section, Josh wants about halfway houses, et cetera. Some of them really are pretty bad, frankly, and the patients are being charged $500-$600 a month.
$700.
Yes. And and they have 10 people at home and a home that you.
They take 70% of their checks.
So what do we do? Because these are special assistants. I mean, these are people who we know on the list who are living. I can show you some pictures of places, for example.
They've been horrific.
So what? You know. I have a feeling there's that that's almost a human rights violation. They have an advocate. The advocate would say, this isn't something I tell my dog in. Why should I let my patient here? What do you think of that type of... like, here's one. This is 8 months, one room, transitional living. You don't have a lot of special assistance in transitional living, mind you. But
eight bunks in a room?
Here's another one.
At five to six
four beds on the floor in one room. It's a transitional living. They're not licensed.
What?
So
these are halfway houses.
Yeah.
So what role? Yeah, Joy.
Why are the case managers putting them?
Yeah, 500
bucks.
Well,
HR.
I can tell you.
Sometimes members choose. Sometimes and so what I would do if I was an ILC member, is that and I did a site visit like that, if I would send that site visit up to Access. Say, we saw these people living in this environment, and we want to know why.
I think the only way that anything, and that gets...
Some things we can't do about unlicensed studies, but we can definitely look into why the member's there.
And they're asking, do you want to be here?
Well, yeah, do they really explain sometimes their options, because they placed my daughter in a place like that. She had no choice.
And same with my daughter.
She was put in there, and she had a horrific experience.
She ran away. Did yours run away?
Yeah, she called
mine. Mine ran away.
because she was deathly afraid what was going on there.
So
I mean, it's scary. Yeah. I mean, she didn't know. I mean, she was told by the case manager, dumped off there. I mean, they're scared. They're deathly afraid at the time that all that happens. I mean, they're scared to say anything.
And then they get penalized. They run off. They're back on the streets. They get penalized. But that agency got successful placement. That person was successfully placed.
Don't want to bombard her with this because it's her responsibility for us to talk about human rights violations.
Yeah,
Yeah, that's why I was asking, because this is the OHR.
That's okay.
We're talking about the special assistance need. Now, the next question is, what about those who aren't on special assistance when we do? But you gave us an answer with those on special assistance that you would check with the OHR and or send up from the actual say, we saw this site, a number of special assistance clients are at this site. This is a site that is really pretty deplorable. They may not know of options, et cetera, et cetera. That helps, right?
Yes.
Okay. The next question would be, what about those who are just SMI? Should we do the same thing for SMI patients too who may be there? If the non-OHR?
Yeah, I would send it to ACCESS. I send it to that IOC inbox because if it's not special assistance, it may not be looked at by OHR. Frederica actually may have to triage that to a different department of care, but for sure, I mean, that's part of what we want.
Your committee to do with, if you see anything that looks like
send it directly.
No, I sent it to her. That's the way we've worked it out. We've agreed on that. We're going to go through.
She gets the copy of it.
I file grievances, and it was just like.
But that's what we're doing here. We're trying to learn this.
But I mean, part of when you guys do your site visits, we had. I don't think it was this committee, was it, Larry? But one of the committees went out and did some site visits, and they sent they used a form for theirs, and they sent the whole form and said, we were able to follow up on the concerns that they had, and that gave us the right site, the right, make sure it was the right health plan, the right provider.
You know what would be nice for us to hear some of that feedback of what you're doing and the result of our reporting it to you, because sometimes I feel.
Anything you send through that formal process, you get feedback on.
Yeah, we haven't done that.
Mm-hmm. In writing, for sure.
Do you have a comment in this particular, or you just have a place you want us to visit?
No, I just don't want you to leave because I think you want to hear what I have to say.
I'm sure I do.
Okay.
I'm kind of nervous, but I'm happy.
If you want to speak now, is it appropriate? Because we're going to move on the agenda. Is this something else?
Can I? Yes, I would like to.
About what? About this issue of OHR?
No, not this issue. My issue, the reason why I'm here.
Okay. Then we'll wait on that. Okay? Because public call will be towards the end. Let's go through a few other items. And are you going to stick around, CJ, or you want to leave?
Yeah, I'm going to stay.
Then will the committee take this out of order? Okay. Go for it, Karen.
Okay, my name is Karen Patico. I've been in the mental health system for a long time, even before the annex was open. I've been a social worker. I've been an administrator. I've worked over at Apios Jail, worked at Public Health. I worked over at Superstition Mountain Mental Health. I ran the 10th Ed Psychiatric Unit. Been involved in the three entities, the Kodamas, the Value Options, and Magellan. So I'm coming here. Because for the last 10 years, I've been sort of in private practice in the private sector, and I don't know why I took this job as a social service director of this facility. I have two issues, and I think what I'm going to be doing, because I know it's short of time, is I'm going to be giving silos of information. If you want more, that's great, but I think this is a big picture of what I see going on in the system right now. I have two issues. A systemic issue regarding outpatient services, and I have two outpatient facilities that I want to bring to everybody's attention from my perspective of what is going on. And I also have a systemic issue regarding a healthcare institution. It's a SNF. It's primarily for behavioral health folks. I've been there 2 months, and I wanted to resign in 2 weeks, but they told me I had to stay there a month. Things are starting to change, but I've had to advocate a lot. One of my concerns is the distinction between a SNF that is medical and one that has behavioral health clients. I call them clients, residents, bear with me, patients. There's a difference between services and behavioral care. The facility that I work with, and I would really like to appreciate it if you don't, I mean, I can give you the name of it.
No, don't do that.
You don't
give,
do that,
give
yes.
It to me.
All right,
give
I'll
it
give
to
it to
already.
You. All right. So they operate, there's about, I don't know, 50, 60 of them. And most of them are in California. There's four facilities here, one in Cottonwood, four in the Phoenix area. This facility has, it's located in central Phoenix. My concerns are structural, cultural, and clinical. Structural, I was there about an hour and I started to cry. It stinks, it smells, it's old, it's dirty. I walk in, it is like an old nursing home where they have the curtains. There's four people in a room. A lot of them, they're starting to have, they don't have drawers, stuff is on the floor, clothes are on the floor.
Gains licensure.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, well, they just had another licensure and they were there for wound care follow-up and okay. Didn't matter. Anyway. Sewers are always backing up. Poop is coming out of the tile. I'm in a room.
Poop is coming out of the tile?
Yes. I've seen it. And but they clean it up and they fix the pipes. They don't have the folks there, and I know this is a fringe benefit, but they don't have cable TV, so these people are stuck in their room, especially I think in December. Remember when it was cold and rainy? There's no place for them to go. It's a very nice patio area, very nice outdoor area, but you have to walk to the cafeteria. So these folks are in the room. Many of these folks, and I'll get to it, but just for an example, have one leg, one person's Huntington's. Some of them have a combination of Alzheimer's, dementia, as well as a behavioral health. Most of these people, you're supposed to, the rules say, you're supposed to have a primary diagnosis. You're supposed to have a primary diagnosis of a behavioral health diagnosis, and also the physical health comes later. I have some examples of all the different kinds of diagnoses, the healthcare diagnoses these people have, and most of it is schizoaffective. My concern is that I don't know. I haven't been to the other SNFs and rehabs, just this one. In my view, I mean, I've been around. I'm a clinical director of a number of residential. I do licensuring. I do policies and procedures all the time for these folks. And I don't know how they can stay open. I want to reference something to you out of the licensure. It says no more than two individuals reside in a residential room unless the Nursing Care Institute was operating before October 31st, 1982, and the residential room has not undergone a modification as defined by ARS 36401. So naturally, being the person that I am, I looked up all of this stuff, and this facility, this company, for-profit company, it is for-profit. They have a nice office over at 9200 Beverly Hills Drive in California. Their website says that they've been operating since 1984. I have no idea when they started this nursing home over here, but I can read. And I don't know why they get dinged a lot. I mean, licensure's out there all the time. So that is a structural issue. Let me bring you a clinical. There's a pod here, building here, building here. There's four buildings. There's a cafeteria. They can have about 60 beds. Typically, since I've been there, there's been about 47, 48, 49 individuals there. Four to a room. There's been days that there's been one CNA. Sometimes two. Woohoo! We have three. I don't know how many times we've ever had four. They're starting to look at it because I complained so much. I think I resigned because I didn't want to be fired. At 68, almost 69 years old, I didn't need to be.
So 49 patients in one certified nursing?
What they don't do is when a CNA calls off, they don't have on-call. They say they got on-call. They don't bring in call. They ask the other folks, hey, can you stay over? Or can you come in? Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to do it. so many times, there is maybe two people. We have amputees there. There's a Huntington person there. She keeps going, you know, Huntington. I don't know why she's there. I got a list of people. I don't know why they're there.
We're going to have to, you guys, two more minutes.
Two more minutes. Okay, so I want to bring to your attention.
If I may, Karen.
What?
This is why we do site visits. I know of this place. I had no one to go on a place site visit with the last month since I've learned of this. You know, Joy and I went on one. And if you want to stay on this committee, you got to do the site visits. And that's what we want to do, to talk about this. And we go in there, we can bring in Nancy Barnes, we can bring anyone the hell we want, but when we go there and see it and write it up, then we can speak like Karen is, and she's risking her job on this. But no one has gone on site. And Marie, you put your name out there, thank you. The only one who did put your name out there to say you can go in the last 8 weeks.
And I had doctor.
I'm just saying, the bottom line is, that's why we do site visits. We can't see these places. We got a tip here, and we haven't gone, you know?
Couple more things.
I got a tip. I got a tip a month ago, and the bottom one is, I put out a notice. Who wants to go on the meetings? Who wants to go on site visits? I said to everyone. I didn't say about this one. No, but so what? You don't get to pick and choose your site visits, Josh. You get to go on site visits and maybe
everyone.
Oh, you can. We will.
No.
When we get tips, but you have to have two people. I didn't have two people, Josh. You haven't gone, so don't talk about going. I'm sorry, I'm a little hot on this.
All right, so anyway, just a couple. I need four.
Okay.
All right, so.
I'll give you my 2 minutes. Go ahead.
All right, so they have an assisted living site on one side, and then when a person gets really bad, they go over to the SNF part. All of a sudden, in the morning meeting, look, they're showing pictures of this person's toes that have turned black already. So they ship them off to the hospital. They were there for a couple of days. They amputated about 4 or 5 in each foot. Person comes back. I was told to go do a site, so do a history. I go back there. The person's in the back room on IVs, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he passed away about 4 hours later. This morning in a meeting, and I don't know who the client is, but apparently whoever was supposed to supply the crash cart didn't. And the police, the fire department came out, and the director of nursing said, "Oh, I'm so embarrassed. I don't know. I think this person died." But I'm not sure, but they were talking about it. Anyway, there is a lot more I can tell you about this, but I am very concerned. They say they have rights. Thank goodness for that one person who had an advocate. He came out. He came out about a week or two later. They finally changed her medication. I mean, that was great. She doesn't have a guardian. But if it wasn't for that advocate, because I wanted to see how things played out without me barging in, because I know that I was on the mental health board. They're starting to change things, but I can attest that advocate really helped this one individual. Really did. It's unbelievable. But let me switch.
Why not get them out of there?
That's my thing. I can't get them out of there because
the advocate?
Well, that's a whole nother outpatient story, and I have two issues with outpatient, but Jack's not going to let me talk. How would you like to be where I'm at, and I'm in the grunt work right now, and I've been in administration for years. I'm trying to call a mental health organization and try to get a COE done. Well, it takes days, and then when I do, it takes days. And then when we finally get it done, it was more than the agency submitted it on the 31st. They had to wait because it was a PAD. I recommended guardianship. The woman's an amputee. She can't vouch for herself. Doesn't have to. Anyway, let's see here. Around the 13th, the caseworker said, "Well, we've been putting it in. Crime Stop, they're supposed to come." I found out on the 14th. That Crime Stop didn't even tell the police to pick up the individual, so she's still in our facility. What happened? She had a GI bleed, and she went to Banner, and I don't even know if they pursued the PAD. But the point of this is I was trying to get a hold of the supervisor and the case manager. Dollars for donuts, swear, both of those cell phones, we're sorry, the person that you're trying to call doesn't have a voice message set up yet. This is a supervisor, and this is a case manager.
Of where?
Of
the facility.
We can't use of of an outpatient facility. Yeah, it's a clinic.
Like you can tell it's a clinic, the outpatient facility. You can't tell it's the one working at. Is it like Swara
Clinic? Is it a Reba Clinic?
This one, the one that has the two people, is Community Bridges over there on 16th Street in Osborne.
There you go.
All right. The other one is Community Connections, where now this goes back to what you say. I was doing some work about a year ago, and I noticed that there's not a lot of residential facilities. There is this woman that I met. She had about three or four flop houses. I've seen them. I've been in there. She's in prison now because a lot of the people turned her in. But all the Mercy Care, United, and mostly Mercy Care were referring their individuals to this facility over on about Happy Valley Road.
What's her name?
Wait a second. Which apparently she's in prison.
Find that out.
Yes, and I could give it to you later.
But it was probably in there.
And now, here's my note. I talked to a Christina at, this is Community Partners. We had an individual care. He's on COE. He came to our facility and IV medication. He was in an altercation. That's why he was court ordered petition. Anyway, the case manager said he's on a waiting list for 24-hour residential. But the two people came in, they said, well, we can offer him to go to a room aboard, non-licensed, owned by a person named Jane, and he would have to pay $500 rent. The client said, no, I'm not going to do that. I can go live with a friend. So we were able to arrange for him to go to the next day. The agency picked him up. They went to the doctor. They got a prescription and so forth. I talked to the case manager later, and they didn't even have an address. COT, on IV, okay now, but was going to have him go to this room and board. And so I was able to get an address. So I gave the case manager the address. I don't know. I mean, when I was working at Maricopa Medical Center, when I was running a 10-bed psychiatric hospital, I just cannot believe that people don't have cell phones and they didn't want to amend. I don't know. I just have a lot of concerns, and you guys are talking about it.
Experience.
And I don't know what to do. I mean, everybody says everything is great, but I don't, and I'm not even going to get involved in the case managers who are part of the health plan that call and connect. I mean, I go home every night and have to wash my hair and clothes because I smell. And I don't know, they do too. You cannot go in these rooms and follow up with this outpatient. I'm sorry, I'm talking real fast. 1 minute. All right, I'm done. So I'm planting a seed, and this is the only place.
Thank you. And
I appreciate
it. And anyway, he knows I talk fast anyway. So do you.
Yeah.
So do you.
And we do, and it's very important because, as a side, this location does not have a special assistance person in there, even though probably a high majority of them are SMI. So we can still do a site visit, but there's no one that's located at that address. So that's one of the concerns, but I think we need to do it. And I've been wanting to do this since I talked to Karen a month ago, but we've got to do site visits. And whoever wants to do a site visit at that location, we'll do it, number one. Number two, what I'm going to suggest you do on the other issues, just send me or Josh or anyone here an email. You can be specific, and we cannot attribute it to you regarding, I know this location, I'll take care of that, but about the other case management issues, because we can then, from someone, look at it and just say, hey, what's cooking here, right? Don't you think that would be appropriate, CJ? You know, and we want to do these, and we've gotten some leads in places. That's why we went through these halfway houses just a couple days ago. We want to do this when we're trying, and this is very good. This is important because these places get away with stuff that's, and why the case then?
No accountability. Right? There's no accountability. Yeah.
And they're so stressed out. There isn't enough. And I know I have got policies and procedures. I know two residential facilities out west that want to have individuals live there. But Mercy Care says, no, we're fine. We're full. We're at capacity. We don't need
licensed,
anymore.
Are they licensed facilities?
Yes.
Okay, see.
Yes, there's two of them, and I'm
Joyce.
The person.
Well, not Joyce. Yeah.
No, I just get really upset when you're hearing
and
this.
And I'm sorry.
We find when we're going visiting that there are empty beds.
Yeah.
And yet when we go to these halfway houses, I mean, they're just, they're like sausages in it. No place to put their clothes, nothing. No, I don't know.
They nail closet doors shut. They don't give them phone privileges.
So that's an interesting question when we find, I mean, because we are going places where there are empty beds. Now, but still, we'll get filled if it's like, capacity of 9 and there's 8 there, you know, I'm not too bent, but when there's 3 beds open and
yeah,
a nice place at BHRF, you know, Behavioral Health Residential Facility, you know that, yeah, well, not, some of them are nice. We were a couple places.
Yeah, that were really nice.
Yeah,
and they happen to be on the west side, too.
But anyway, so what do we do? Should we just let you know? It doesn't matter. I mean, that's kind of a, you know, what do you do?
See rights violations.
No, rights violation. What if we see openly? Does it matter?
That's a rights violation. If somebody's living in filth, that's a rights violation.
They won't say it's filth. They'll say the building's old. Oh, we know we have
to remodel. No, but we get to tell. We do a sniff test. See, we don't code violations.
Do you want to smell my hair?
But you can, yeah, you can definitely send your site visit, you know, your notes, your feelings on what the people are going through. So that's why you guys are up there, right? To let us know.
And I have a handful of people that I don't even think need to be there. And what really bothers me is that they said that they get $500 more a day if they say they do behavioral care and they follow this thing and they got this clinical director that comes 1 hour a week and talks to the CNAs about clinical behavioral care approaches. And half of it, I mean, the woman has Huntington. She's going down like this and she's yelling and she's crying. Oh, she's trying to get out. You know, I mean, there's about 5 or 6 people that do not belong there. There's an Alzheimer's person that doesn't belong there. I don't know who.
Okay. This is reminiscent of. This is a totally different take on this than I've ever talked about. But as you're describing it, I remember the first big access to Medicaid fraud case that I saw, and it was in a SNF doing speech therapy, and they had billed, and every patient there got speech therapy and so on and so forth. The only problem was that all but 2 were comatose. And so it was a huge fraud. I think the new tax for these places is Medicaid fraud, is access fraud, because the person with Huntington's disease is or isn't a candidate for all the stuff that they're billing for. And they're billing access a boatload. And I think we go to access, I think we go to the equivalent of the inspector general, and we start turning these places in for fraud.
If I may, I was at a site the other day on another issue where they had a whole calendar of all the activities, and I asked this very competent individual what activities they had. In the 3 weeks there, they've had 2 activities, one was poetry reading and another one was some Tai Chi.
Underwater basket reading.
No, but the bottom line, they had the whole day filled out. So that's one of the concerns we've had before.
Fraud.
But we'll talk about
fraud.
About they're not getting the services that these people are alleging they're getting.
Yeah.
And people can document. They have a wonderful electronic medical record. Oh, it is so spiffy. Another person came from Tucson, and she lays in bed. She can't get up. She's bedridden. They had this big isolation with the flu last week. Oh, but anyway, some of these people do not need to be billed for behavioral health. Maybe years ago. But now their dementia is so far advanced.
What kind of behavioral health service are they getting?
They have a psychologist at this facility that comes in once a week. He was there today for an hour to talk to the CNAs about behavioral health approaches. They don't have anybody else. That's why they hired me. I'm an LCSW, and I was going to do counseling, but I can't do counseling because I don't know where to do it because everything smells. Oh, one last thing. They have an activities room, 47 people. Guess how many people can be in that activities room at one time? 17. It's dark, it's dingy, it smells.
But we're going to move on.
All right, thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you for coming.
No,
I
know
you'll come back.
Well, I got to get the okay from this guy. No.
How are you?
No, I just, and I would appreciate if.
She's on the committee with him.
Right? I'm on the mental health committee.
What
mental health? Association.
Mental health association.
Oh.
American.
Yeah. So anyway, I would appreciate if you didn't dive in. And by the way, my name was given to Jill, the chief clinical officer over at Access.
Sure,
yes, we've been playing telephone tag. So if you see her, you can tell her, well, I talked to this kid.
Karen, how do you spell your last name?
Oh, dear. Okay.
Don't say it out loud.
Write it down.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, Jack can give it to you.
Okay, yeah. Sounds good.
I think anybody who listens to this tape is going to know who you are.
And my last day is next
still
Friday.
Keep her under a cloak.
You know, I made it this far. I'm licensed. I just don't need to be, but thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You want to, okay, you can sit this way if you want. A couple other things. Let's talk to, by the way, this reminds me of that movie Titicut Follies. Right, Holly?
What?
Are you familiar with Titicut Follies, the famous movie of the insane asylum in Massachusetts?
I'm not familiar.
No, we just know one of all
the It is. It's a famous documentary. Okay. Why don't we...
I got to go.
Thank you, CJ.
Thank you very much. It was very helpful.
Yeah, thank you. I got your email.
Mr. Allen's now going to talk about some of the DOA stuff. He's got some announcements and some other... He's going to update us.
It's a hard act to follow.
On the Abuse and Neglect Task Force.
Yep, sure. I'll be brief. We had a meeting with, back up real quick. Governor Ducey had tasked Access with forming a task force to go over the main points that, I guess, the pitfalls that you guys see on a day in, day out basis, which she just talked about. To really kind of dive into the details of what's been driving all the issues.
I'm sorry, what kind of task force?
It's a task force that Governor Ducey put together. She asked Access, or Governor Ducey asked Access to spearhead this, which was approximately, I don't know, 75 people.
So it was
it's the Arizona Abuse and Neglect Task Force.
Yes.
It's quarterly meetings that people from Access, DES, DOA, DDD,
Department of Health, everybody.
I don't know anything about it, but the fact that I don't know about it means nothing.
IOCs were mentioned in the task force report, specifically number 6 in the report. And basically, what it boils down to is that the agencies and ADOA need to create flowcharts for members, IOC members, on how complaints are handled and a timeline on how they're handled.
What do we have to do with abuse and neglect? I feel like I'm missing something.
Well, okay, you're not. What happened is the governor said, who are the people who see some of this stuff? And right now, the big push was from DDD. They're the ones who are spearheading this, I would suggest, right? And they're the ones they've worked with for a while.
That's correct. They're in charge of one portion
right.
of it. Yeah.
But they're the ones who had more input initially because of the mentally ill and the reporting task force was not done. Yeah.
Oh, that's Access as much.
And so what I'll do is I'll send you the link to the original report that the governor's formation of this task force saying, hey, this is where the IOCs need to be involved because they deal with abuse and neglect issues. And what they're going to look at is a statewide common scheme for dealing with abuse and neglect. So it's not like each AG has to go here, there's be a nice, easier format to do so. So there was a meeting that the chairs of the committees and various other people were invited to. And that's what we're talking. That's what he's reporting on right now.
Right.
So
the agencies and ADOA are creating flowcharts for how a claim or how a so say you have an issue that y'all vote on as a committee, and you want to investigate it more. You submit that to ADOA and submit it to Access. Then the clock will start. Okay, so the agency has to respond within 5 days. Okay.
That's a big change.
That is a big change. So we track that internally. I track that for all the committees.
And do you go to the governor if they don't respond within 5 days?
I go to the director of ADOA.
But we try
and then that will go to, and then that gets escalated up.
We tried to get this in the law when we redid the statute, Josh. I'm trying to figure out when it was. I'm maybe misremembering. And there was a lot of discussion, and we were just told then 2 years ago that was not possible.
Well, they have to address the issue within 5 days of when they receive the question or complaint. And if there's not any resolution to that, then they escalate that up to, I guess, CJ's level, which would be the Bureau Chief. And then they have 21 days to get the resolution back to you guys for an answer.
Okay.
So, and we're putting together flowcharts on that. So, and how DDD handles their issue, internal complaints, how access. So that's what the task force is really kind of getting
done.
Get kind of dovetailing everything together and putting the puzzle together, so to speak, and getting that back out to everybody so they'll know how the information flows.
And I've just sent you now, all of you in the committee, the minutes from that first quarterly meeting. Okay. And CJ on the we inquire about telephone privileges and some limitations. She said she'll get back within 14 days of the inquiry, because the last 2 months ago we said the committee authorized me to send a letter about phone privileges, et cetera, and the cases don't get them. So she said she's going to respond within 2 weeks. She's going to try it. And as an aside, if I may, Larry, she's saying to direct things from this committee through her in some ways, because it may be able to have some statewide impact, because some of our issues may be the same, not just go to Mercy Care, but go to her, because then it may have impacted Northern Southern, which I thought was very positive for CJ to say that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that very responsible thing.
Yeah, so, and that's pretty much it, Jeff. I mean, the meeting itself that we had back in January was pretty much a 20,000 feet in the air meeting.
Yeah.
It was a lot of information, so we're on the ground level here. So what we're doing, what I'm going to be doing, is putting a meeting together with all the chairs and really kind of finishing up the flow chart that I'm doing for ADOA to discuss that, any other issues that we may have, and then we're going to have the second quarter meeting with the task force coming up sometime in April. I'm not sure yet. They haven't set it out yet. But if you did get the news bulletin that I sent out to the group, it has a link to that task force report. So if you need that again, let me know. I'll be happy to send it out to you.
I want to assuage my concerns and ours that ADOA was not going to be as involved as the manual was indicating would be. Remember, we were concerned about that, and I don't see that happening. I'm just really pleased with the continuing support, and I am. And I think both the rest of the state is, too.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Let's, anything else? We're going to do site visits, and then we're going to get out of here in time. I'm sorry this went long, but I thought, did you not think that was valuable?
It was valuable, absolutely.
I thought it was really good for me to get that.
Absolutely.
Why don't we do site visits? Joy and I went and specifically just picked halfway houses. By the way, there's only about 30 special assistance folks on that are living in halfway houses, the transition. So at least they list them by halfway house of transition living. So you can break down the list. So it's not as many. There's more. There's 80 homeless who are on special assistance now. Most of the ones we saw, the homes we went to, though, were full of SMIs, but not special assistance. But you want to tell about the three places?
Well, I was pretty discouraged after visiting, especially the first one that had, they had 9 tenants, all female, and they each were paying $520 a month. They have to pay for their own food. But, I mean, they were so crowded and no place for their clothes. I mean, really. I mean, did you see any dressers there or anything like that? It might have been like nightstands.
On the past, my phone with that one bedroom with 4, there was none. They said they had them.
Yeah, and When I went in the bathroom, there was no towel rack, so I asked him, well, what do you do with your wet towels? Oh, they just hang them anywhere, anything they can on the corner inside their room. That's what they're doing. You know, so this is what it was. See, I did look in there. I mean, the tub was rusty. It really needs caulking and things. There were no shelves in the bathroom. All the cleaning products were on the floor. They really didn't have any privacy at all.
I don't see how this is past licensure.
It's not licensure.
It's not, see, that's
we're
going to
talk about
that.
That's
the
other
thing. See, this is why it's upsetting me to think that the case managers are putting them into places like this. Yeah.
I've seen refugee camps in East Africa that are this good.
It's like a camp cabin.
What was really interesting about this, in spite of all
this,
this
is what this is a killer, wasn't it?
Yeah, about the ones that how they encourage each
and the woman loved it.
They said it was better than sleeping on the streets, and they were encouraging each other. If one needed a hug, they have a hug. But it still bothers me because I think they deserve better. Why are they put in a place like this? I mean, that's the bottom line on that.
That's not even a bed.
Yeah.
It's almost like cots.
It looks like a camp. It looks like a camp cot cabin.
What do we know? What they get reimbursed?
That's a house, by the way.
Do we know what they get reimbursed per bed per day?
They have to pay $520
a month.
Plus they have to pay their own food to it.
No, this is not this is no billing. This is a trend.
Yeah.
They pay rent.
I think that's one.
So, but let's talk about the other two, and then we can talk about the issue that you brought up, Josh, about licensure.
Well, Josh, like when my daughter was placed there, the guy wanted her to sign a paper to sign over a social security check over to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, things like that going on. And the second place we went was very...
Hold on. Can we pause on that one first? In that situation, the human rights violation potentially is the fact that SMI individuals are living in that, I won't call it a facility, but they're living there.
Yeah.
So wouldn't that be a clinical issue that the team decided that was an appropriate place to live? Or technically, is that not even... Can we say
well, that? No, I don't know what they decided, but I believe the clinical issue is why did you let your client live there?
Right.
Yeah, so I think that's the issue.
Who
we need
put
to
them
answer.
There?
Well, who knows? You know, who knows?
Well, that's the question. Who assigned them to that place? And
Holly, if it looked like my child, the case manager
took
her there.
Case managers do it.
Okay.
But the problem is these women, this is the interesting issue.
Yeah.
Wouldn't move if you asked them to.
I
think if you showed them something, it'd be
right.
Different.
Right. I don't think they realize
that there's something else.
That's
right.
Yeah. That's
well,
the thing.
If you've been living it,
I know.
16th and Van Buren, that's a step up in the world, right?
Yeah. I know it well.
Yes.
But it's...
They don't know what else is out there.
Well, we need more money. $1.5 billion is just not enough.
And the thing is, too, I think they bonded so well, the women... that if one was down, they said they hug them and they give the encouragement. Where would you get that other place?
And one of them was working.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
How do you live in that place and go to work?
They do. Okay.
Well, is the clinic paying for this? Or is
no.
It,
oh, okay. They're SSI. They're SSI.
Yeah.
Okay, or SSDI, some of them.
Yeah,
okay.
The second place, it was all males. There were 7 residents there, the capacity. They had 3 baths. They were paying $500 a month. What was nice, that place was extremely clean. That was nice. I mean,
was that the one that had the bunk bed, so?
Yeah, no.
That was the last one, right?
Yeah, that was the last one. This place was completely redone on the inside. I mean, that, to
this
me,
is
it was
the inside
beautiful.
Of that one.
I mean,
and then the next, that's the outside of that one. So here's the...
This one was really nice.
This is the one you're talking about
I mean,
now?
They redid the whole inside. I mean, it was just...
They flipped the house
and
tiled everything, painted it, made it look nice, and it was actually quite nice.
Yeah.
That living room area.
Yeah.
We just saw the picture of the living room.
Yeah, and the residents were very happy. They said they had great food and everything there, but again, that's a halfway house, and they're paying $500 a month.
$500 a month. They're probably getting $700, $800.
No, are they paying for the food?
Is that included?
That's a pretty house.
Well,
yeah,
by the way, the first place didn't have cable TV with that rent, didn't have cable TV, didn't have a phone. No phone, no landline.
It's interesting in this one particular place. One of the residents was there 12 years. Remember the one out there? He was there 12 years, and he loves the place. You know, I mean, but it was clean. It was really nice. You know, if they're willing to pay it, you know, they seemed to be happy. And then the third place again, like it stunk. As you walked in, it was awful. I'm sorry.
It was 11. It had 11 beds. They had three bedrooms. This is a third bedroom.
Yeah. They were paying $600 a month.
And that's eight. They had a one meal included.
Yeah.
And here's the. Is this the Fresh Start one with the one meal one? With the guy was really nice guy, and they have a woman's house down the street.
Yeah.
He was a nice guy who tried to do the right thing,
right.
But they had eight in the run worm. And they here's their contract.
So for $60,000 a month, that's all they can do.
$6,000 a month.
Sorry,
$6,000 a month. Oh, that's.
This one, they're paying $600 a month.
So,
and then you pay $10 extra if you want internet access.
So, what does the committee want to do? I mean, this is problematic, and I think we have some answers. We can just say that, you know, I heard some answers from CJ that what we can do is simply say, this place doesn't look like a habitable place, and there's some real issues. These patients with special assistance being there.
But these are special assistants.
No, there's someone special assistant in that house. We wouldn't have gotten in otherwise, two who were there. But my point is, I think this is, is that the way we should approach this? On this? And then say, why is case managers involved in this, et cetera, et cetera. What do you guys think?
So when I was a case manager, people would live in inappropriate environments, but that was their choice, right?
Yes.
So they had the ability to make their own informed decision. So if those people at the first halfway house that you went to are choosing to live there, and the case manager is doing home visits and those kind of things, and their basic needs are getting met, do we have any recourse other than saying, even if we made rules for case managers, they can't place somebody unless that has X, that wouldn't change the fact that all these people are choosing to live there.
Well, I think what that's, these pictures and the reports speak to a lack of standards and a lack of enforcement of those standards.
So do we say you can't stay at any place that isn't licensed? Like, that sounds like a move that we could make. Like, people's rights are getting violated because they're not staying at licensed facilities.
I didn't think Mercy Maricopa placed people in unlicensed facilities.
Yes,
all they do.
Yeah, all the time.
Oh, yes, all the time.
They said they didn't place, we heard them say something else, but you're right.
What if you put someone in an apartment complex that's not
Josh and Holly,
Josh was concerned about this, and you're talking about statutory remedies that halfway housing, transitional living, and Larry and I were talking about it earlier, because this is number one, does the ADA preclude you from complaining about these places? Does the ADA say you can't stop these people from moving in? And I've heard that. I don't know if Jeff Coombs wrote about it in the article one time, but that's one question. Number two, is that an issue we need to address? Is say, should they start at least have some minimal licensure requirements for these transitional living homes? Because I've been to some that make these look like the Hyatt, you know, down on Southern and in Mesa, you know, where they have,
Is there any government funding involved?
No. It's all that's no. There's no government paid.
No,
there's no charge, nothing.
Well, and anything that you do, presumably the market is setting the rates, and anything you do is going to raise the cost.
Except by how much you get by SSI.
No, but she's saying if we force them to get licensed or something like that, then it's going to cost more for these places.
But the reality is there'll still be flop houses that will take whatever they can get.
That's a problem.
Anybody
that has money, go out and buy a house.
Yeah.
You know, semi-flip it and say, okay, we're open for business.
For 10 people.
And there's no there's no regulation, there's no license, there's nothing. And they can just start, you know, 700 a head, 500 a head, 600 a head. Don't feed them, don't clean, you know, do anything. But they're up there, and they're having people placed in there. I experienced that because of, you know, with my daughter personally. I know, Marie, if you've experienced that, experienced that. I mean, it's criminal. It's absolutely criminal.
By saying that case management or SMI clinics shouldn't refer to a
unlicensed, unregulated facility.
Or someone out of this stuff. I don't even know if that's an appropriate report for us to make.
No, but then SMI members still need to be able to make choices unless they cannot make choices. And so
that's right.
I,
absolutely.
I,
This isn't an informed choice. That's the problem.
I'm just asking what can we do.
It sounds like a bunch of them, they are making informed choices.
I think here's the issue. They're making a choice, but they're not it's not informed in the sense they don't know the alternatives.
Exactly.
And that is an informed choice, as you know. Right. Has to be informed choice. Have to have the alternatives.
Yeah, but they don't have alternatives.
I know. My point being a way of getting at this is saying, hey, you know, these are some other options for you. You know,
I don't know.
I'm asking.
For some reason, I'm not bothered by the pictures you just showed me. I'm bothered by what Karen talked to me about, a licensed facility that's getting paid by a plan, by the SMI system to provide services, and they're doing a terrible job, and people are dying. Here, people are autonomous. They're using their own cash to go and to pay rent for someplace. We shouldn't be able to take that away from them. I do not like the idea of that at all.
But Josh, they may not know their options.
And you missed
there, you know.
That was only that one house. The other ones. One was there. We want to move out. I want the guy called it transitional.
Yeah.
My goal is to get him out of here within so many days. But so the point is.
But there aren't alternatives. There's a waiting list for vouchers that's 2,400 people long. Mm-hmm. So okay, you can go to this place where there's bunk beds, or you can go live at Cass. I don't know why it doesn't bother me. I wish they were nicer, but I'm not sure how the government steps in and creates minimums for these places.
I guess,
to say every if you're SMI, you can't go to an apartment or you can't go and live at this flop house or whatever. I think that's pretty intrusive and it takes away a lot of autonomy.
Well, and Josh, what I was trying to say is I don't think that we have any options. I don't think there is anything that we can force. Like, I was just trying to throw ideas. What are the possibilities? I don't think there really are any.
Well, what about the empty beds that are not in these homes that we're visiting in group homes? I mean, why aren't they placed in there?
Yeah.
Well, play devil's advocate. If I'm a case manager and I go to Joe, Joe's living in one of those houses, I say, hey, Joe, you want to leave? I can get you this thing. And Joe's like, no, we can't.
I understand that. Before they were initially placed there, why aren't they given that option?
We don't know if they are.
It's reimbursement rates.
Yeah, I mean, Matthew, I think that's a good point. That maybe one thing to say is when they come out of an institution or off the streets, the priority absolutely is a licensed facility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the case manager, if they want to move around, we can't stop that. We can't stop that. Nor should we. But at least we can say, hey, you don't have to be dropped down to the kennel, as the first officer shown, at least a case manager can say, hey, you can go here. If you want to leave there and be with your buddies, you can do that. That's right.
But that's why they started applying medical necessity a few years ago, is because then you have to meet a criteria to get into a place, and if you don't, then you don't get to access the treatment centers. So
I'm talking those who come out of hospitals. Obviously, it's medical necessity. If they're coming out of a level one facility, in almost all cases, I would argue, they should not go to the streets, which is essentially what they're doing in these places. So that's a level one. We've seen COT patients under court order coming out of level one hospital going to shelters. That we believe is clearly erroneous, as you'd say. So I think you have look at those with medical necessity. Start there. Homeless, not maybe. Getting them off the streets, the first thing. If they want to go to this flop house, by God, that's better. I'm just throwing stuff out, guys. This is for us to discuss. You know,
it's really tough.
Especially mm-hmm. for the parents, especially for the SY, because you're the ones who, Kathy and Joy, are the ones who are speaking, and Marie are speaking to against these places because their daughters, children, had no choice. No procedure.
They have a place there.
Yeah.
And they're scared. You know, they don't want to sleep on the streets. They don't sure. realize that they have no choice.
Yeah.
Josh, you know, the manager, the place where my daughter's placed, I mean, he pulled in a room and wanted to show her pornography, telling her that's part of her treatment plan.
What?
Yeah. This is in one of these houses.
Who did this?
The manager
of the house.
It's not licensed.
The halfway. It's not licensed, yeah.
Behavioral health treatment, so.
And she was not allowed to get near the phone, and she was deathly afraid. So during the night, somehow she got to the phone and called the police, and they picked her up.
And this was here in Phoenix.
Yeah, this is
not atypical.
The happy houses are gross. I don't think anyone's...
She was in a halfway house.
That's where they put her, the case manager. Well, same thing with Kathy and your daughter too, right, Marie?
That makes no sense to mix a halfway house resident who are on probation or parole.
And they did the same thing with sober living houses. They'll put SMI in with sober living.
Yeah.
So let's keep that in mind. We should break. You know, is Jim still on the line? But I really appreciate doing it. It is important to look at these issues.
I'm just trying to think of the legal theories. If the member complained and said, I don't want to live in this squalor, the SMR rights would say that they have a right not to live in a place like that. And so I think that could start a chain of events where we could get the person out. We could raise the issue of these terrible places. But if they're choosing to be in there,
And that's usually to do with $600 a month. Yeah, actually, you can still get some very decent places. You can share an apartment with four people, two bedroom apartment. So for that, you know.
When you keep just running away.
But you're right. No, that's an interesting question. But I think we got to address that because we've seen some people who shouldn't be there and who the potential for abuse is there.
Well, I think in theory, I'm thinking about the apartment issue. Yes, in theory, but you've got to have a credit report. You've got to have. If you're two SMI individuals and you got all your stuff in a black, glad trash bag, and you go to try to rent an apartment. My daughter lives. You can see it from here. A lovely, place. It could 3-4 people can live there. But they don't have a job, they don't have a credit report, they don't have the things that you've got to have to get in. So that's the problem. They can't.
Here's the other thing, Holly, though. These places exist because they, and mostly because of the SMI or disabled, because they get SSI.
Yeah.
Okay. So we know that one of the ways we may be able to associate change is say, hey, like this one person said, you need to get lockers. And he was very open to getting lockers. One of the things is say, hey, maybe the case managers can work with them and say, you need to get dressers for your people because I'm dropping them out, I'm coming and checking out. I'm not bringing people here. That may be an economic way of saying, we're relying on this $600 a month.
I think that the issue is whether a case manager, I can't imagine that if you are the source of bringing 11 people potentially once or twice a year with normal turnover, that you can't say to the guy,
absolutely,
no more people till no tiki, absolutely, no laundry, no more people here until you have a closet, until you have drapes, until you have the beds, a dresser, a microwave oven, and cable TV. And if it eats into your margin, if you make $400 a month less, well, hey, that's the price of doing business.
There's one bed I'm not going to fill for you.
Can we put this on the agenda for next meeting?
Yes.
I think it warrants a lot more discussion.
I think it also warrants a higher up discussion in Mercy Maricopa.
But I agree, but we've done some things and we can do them. So I would suggest next thing is site visits. We need to do the site visits. I'm going to go where Karen was. There's mental health assistance, there's SMI there. Does anyone want to go with me on that visit? Well, you can go without me. I don't care. But we all need to commit because that's part of our ethos. It's part of our obligation to go on site visits.
I'll go with you if you don't yell at me, Jeff.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, the problem is we have to make a living.
You know what? So do I, dear.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and I'm not married to a gas passer.
Well, but okay. this
don't go on that.
Sometimes meetings start late.
I didn't mean that. I'm talking about going to Cyprus. I don't care about the coming late.
Hey, look, Trump's in town too, so traffic was crappy. Okay, so
site visits. Does anyone want to pick any dates or time right now for site visits?
I gotta
go next weekend.
The weekends I'm not on.
I can't.
It's hard for me. Okay.
Well, Monday was good to do that. We did that.
Gonna work on my desk.
Shall we just send it out again, Marie? You are the only one who did that, and I thank you for that because we all agreed that we would send out a time when we're available, right? And we all agreed on that. That hey, I'm able to go on Friday the 25th at 2 a.m. Anyone want to join me?
So if someone 2 a.m.
That is a really surprise visit.
Yeah, okay.
We've been lucky getting in. They balked at that first one, didn't they? Okay, so let's each send an email out, please. Does that make sense? About when you want, what's best for you to do it on, and then we can see who can jump on board.
Well, if you do things on the west side, then I'm more...
Yeah, we.
I don't have a car that can go real far.
I want to know. That's
my problem. Yeah. If you do the west side, then I can...
So... when's the next meeting going to be? And I think Matthew will put this on the agenda. It's a big issue. I actually gave an email to Charles Sullivan to see if he'd join us, and maybe he can talk about housing too.
March 18th is our next meeting.
Reba, I'd like to know what they think
Charles,
about this.
Yeah, I think the REVA is the appropriate.
Well, this was four different issues. Joining us again. To be a member again because we need housing.
I'd like to talk about that before we.
All I'm doing is saying people. I'm putting out interest. People are interested. I'm not saying they're going to get on the committee. I'm saying we need to put out feelers for people who are interested, and I'm going to do it individually. We can all do it individually. You're doing it individually, right?
No.
I guess.
Sorry. You can talk to me privately.
Well, no, I think that before we...
I'm not offering any positions to anyone. I'm saying, seeing as there's anyone interested.
Okay. Well, I think...
Members. Who wants to be a member?
Oh.
I mentioned to Charles or Bill Jones, you want to come and think about being a member maybe.
Uh-huh.
Doesn't mean I'm guaranteeing him a spot doing anything. It's, you know, Joy's been working on a probation officer for the last month or two, and he couldn't make it this time.
Yeah, he couldn't.
I don't know the guy. None of you probably do. So that's Joy.
Actually, he's a supervisor there, and he's only
yeah,
that's
so yeah. Anyone can bring anyone.
I think all I'm saying is that for people that we know, that members of the committee know, and who've been on the committee before, it would be nice to talk about whether to ask them to consider coming back. Because that just would be nice, because I don't think it's...
We'll have to go into maybe. Anyway, so we're going to meet at here. Can we meet here again?
Sure.
Can we get... Okay. We'll need to clean the phone thing up and whatever.
I already have a fix for that.
Okay, so it'll work for both of you, so keep the Google, our minutes and everything. Okay, great.
Don't get too crabby now, otherwise he's going to take this back, so don't get too crabby.
No, but it'd be just as he wants to be.
Be nice, play nice, play nice. Part. Okay, all right.
5:30 on March 18th. St. Patrick's Day, 17th?
Yes, sir.
17th.
You're not Irish.
Nordic. Thanks a lot. That was a good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that'd be a Panama. Well, I just talked to someone who was down there.
Really?
Yeah, I thought a guy who was living there.
Virus getting around.
Yeah. On the cruises, yeah. But you know what? You can take some medicine as a prophylaxis against viruses.
Okay.
Yeah, except for the other ones like that. Tamiflu.
Oh yeah, it's double star day tomorrow at Starbucks, guys.
Bye. Thanks a lot for coming. You could have left early. Thank you. Seriously.
Mary, when did you send out that last report?
Oh, goodness. It would have been sometime in early January.
Okay, okay.
Do you need that?
She forwarded it to me.
Oh, okay.
I just thought maybe you were talking about another
one. Oh, no.
I'll go back.
Yeah, we switched to a quarterly meeting, bulletin, just because there's not a whole lot of material out there for everybody, so. Take a look at it. All fancy here. Should be able to sit power on.
Thanks. Thank you, man.
No problem, Dr. Potts.
Can you hand me that bottle?
No.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Thank you very much.
No problem, bud.
Thanks for staying late.
Oh, yeah, no problem. It was a good meeting.
Coming from you, I'm going to take that as a compliment because you've gotten a lot of these.
No, you're good. Guess so. I couldn't hang the phone up.
Oh.
Do you know the password or anything?
Be all right.
I think. And it looks like it's password protected. Yeah, I couldn't.
Can't do nothing. I think it's frozen.
Kind of locked up.
Oh, there we go.
Guess it's it. Oh, there you go. Oh, there you go. Perfect.
Phone call done now.
It's over.
Thank you. question.